see. I'm hearing nothing. My intro music is gone. Do you hear anything? Well, welcome back to the wonderful reprise of the Skid Row Chatter Show, and hopefully you're hearing me out there, world. And I have my guest, Jeremy Rush, here on, well, you know, I don't want to go right into the intro because I'm listening to my own voice echo in the background. Here, let me take care of that. Jeremy Rush, writer and director of Wheelman. If you haven't already seen Wheelman, you should probably check it out immediately, but I suspect if you're tuning in, you have already seen the movie. Jeremy, welcome. Uh-oh. Are you there? Didn't you hear me?
Hear me?
There you are.
All right. There we go. Thank you for having me on, man.
All right. You know, I'm just going to silence my computer, and we'll go directly with that. So, you know, I'm just bear with me. Take a second. I've got a terrible, terrible echo, and I'm not going to be able to function.
Oh, yeah, that's awful when that happens.
Let's see. How's that? Well, unfortunately, I don't have my sheet of questions printed out, so I'm going to have to deal with it. But listen, let's talk about the movie first.
Whoops, did I lose you?
Can you hear me?
Oh, there you are.
And I'm back now.
I lost you for a second.
All right. Well, because I walked away from the computer. Let me see. Let me try one more time.
Sure.
And how about now? Can you hear me okay?
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
All right. We're back in business. All right. Let me start from the top again. The movie Wheelman is featured now on Netflix and did incredibly well world round. And I like to tell people this movie is wholly unique because it is. It's a weird movie. It's arty. It's a smart movie. It's a shoot 'em up crime film, and it's a tough combo to balance. Where did the idea for this come from?
Yeah, great question. I'm a huge fan of 70s films. You know, 60s and 70s maybe. Bullet, French Connection, Duel, Taxi Driver. You know, car movies. I think Taxi Driver is a really underrated car film. And so all those car, Vigilante, Vanishing Point, all those great car movies from the 70s. And I have been writing screenplays on spec for, maybe 12 years and working production to support myself. And was writing scripts, kind of just trying to figure out how to learn how to write. So I wrote a handful of really crappy scripts and a couple of decent scripts, and then finally said, you know, I got like one more script in me, and I got to make something of this. So if I'm going to write one more script, and then maybe hang the gloves up, I want to write something that I like. So I took all the shit that I like. I like performance driving, and I like cars. I like shootouts. I like noir films. I like mentor-apprentice relationships, like the father-daughter relationship in the film. And I kind of took all of that and put it into an outline and what really kind of broke the story for me was coming up with the fixed point of view. And from there,
well,
the script came very quickly.
What was it? Was it a tough sell? You know, it being, you know, like, you know, pitching that the whole movie is in, which isn't entirely true, but it's essentially in the car, has got to be off-putting to an investor. But it, you know, it ends up working in a lot of ways, and it creates a really sort of unique intensity. But was it a tough sell convincing that it was gonna work, that your vision was gonna work?
You know, it honestly, it probably should have been. For a first-time director to come in with a kind of a risky take on a story like that, it honestly should have been probably a red flag for everybody involved. But, you know, everybody very early on knew that was the intention. I think the third line in the screenplay is an italicized parenthetical that says, unless otherwise noted, the camera is always inside the car. So the third line of the script pretty much sets up that visual design premise. And along with the screenplay, I also had a probably 75 or 80 page visual reference book that has references from other films, you know, screen grabs essentially, and then my own text description beneath those screen captures to describe what I like about that particular frame from that particular film. So lighting, camera placement, composition, use of a color palette, et cetera, et cetera. So I came to the table with a fairly in-depth, comprehensive plan for how to execute. And, I, you know, I think that's what got me over the hump to get into the driver's seat. A little bit of help from monster gorilla producer Joe Carnahan. If he had not backed me up and vouched for me to direct this film, there would be no Wheelman, so there would be no Wheelman without Joe Carnahan, and then quickly after that, Frank Grillo. But no, I never ran into any hurdles with that fixed POV. I mean, there were some questions while we were shooting the film, because what occurred to everybody, including myself, is that if that concept, that fixed camera position concept, being that the camera is either inside the car or mounted exterior to the car pretty much for the duration, if that concept doesn't work in a single scene, the entire movie does not work. And I don't think that really occurred to everyone until we were maybe a week or two into shooting. So there were some cold feet on that visual style concept, but nothing that we didn't overcome just by kind of put our heads down and just sticking to the game plan.
Like I say, even it creates a weird intensity, and it didn't really occur to me. It's kind of a strange film in the sense that if you're not told that it's the camera's always with the car, in the car, or at the side view mirror, you don't really notice until about, you know, halfway through, and it occurs to you when there's scenes that are happening outside the car, but the camera is still in the car. You're seeing them from inside the car, and that's when, you know, that's when it hit me, like, oh yeah, we've been in the car the whole time. It's really it's an arty thing to do for such a heavy crime film, you know, for such a gritty movie.
It's a weird movie, man. Like you said in the intro, it's on paper it's a weird film. I think actually one of the finest compliments that the film can get on my behalf as the director is that the visual style, that very specific visual style, is not intrusive into the experience. So you're, you know, fortunately not the only person to say that they didn't realize that that was kind of the conceit until, I don't know, like you said, halfway into the film.
Yeah, I'm thinking the bar scene specifically. I don't want to get too spoilery in case a few listeners haven't seen it. But you know what else struck me about
even
this?
Mm-hmm. Just real quick, even writing the screenplay, you know, since I knew that the fixed POV was going to be the visual design of the film, it actually allowed for some of those scenes later on where we stay in the car with one character while another character is off doing something else in the distance. And so, you know, we've seen this story. This particular story is not fresh. It's not a new one. We've seen this 1,000 times. But even in the scripting part of the process, that fixed POV allowed for some scenes and some moments that we have not had a chance to see in other films, because we'd be outside the car, you know, across the parking lot, or like you said, inside the bar while the while those other scenes that are off camera are going down. So it really allowed for, we called it the POV, the driver's seat POV. So basically whoever's in the driver's seat of the car, that's who we stick with.
You know, another thing that is kind of fresh on an older take about this movie is, you know, when I first started writing, it was very intimidating to sort of deal with cell phones, and as a fiction writer, to deal with cell phones, because they're so often a shortcut, and it, you know, you have characters doing things. Well, why wouldn't they just call and get themselves out of trouble? So you do sort of little plot device, you know, that no service, or you run out of charge. But this movie not only, you know, overcomes that, it's you use them so effectively, they almost become, it's almost like a character, you know. And it's was that part of the intention, or was that something they just sort of had to happen because you were keeping in the car and that's the only way it could work?
Maybe a little bit of both. I mean, I knew, and it's a great point. I have to say, by the way, it was one of my maybe greatest anxieties making this movie was the cell phone stuff, because I fucking hate cell phones. I hate them in real life, and I don't like the way, like you said, that they're conveniently rendered somehow inoperable for solutions in films. It's just silly. And so that was definitely a challenge to overcome for this film. I think that we really tried to minimize how much we show the phone and how we use it. Pat, our editor, he did a great job at kind of helping me pinpoint when to show the phone. So sometimes we're using it to establish the character's voice, and we see the incoming call with the name of that character on the phone. Or we're using it to, you know, not just for, I guess, expositional purposes. We're not just purely getting information across. We're doing that, but also always trying to do something else. I mean, maybe he hangs up on somebody, and then we show the cell phone, the dark screen, and we're pushing in very subtly on that dark screen as he's, you know, tensely waiting for that damn phone to ring, that person to call back. So I think trying to use it not just to convey information, but also trying to use it for some dramatic purposes, and then maybe most of all, just not overusing that cell phone.
It was intentionally very early on
to utilize it. Oh, sorry, I overlapped with you then.
I was just going to say that it absolutely intensified and created a suspense, because there's a couple moments in the film where, you know, the main character is on the phone. He's unable to act on anything that's happening on the other end of the phone. And it reminded me a lot of, it was like Rear Window, you know, that Hitchcock type. And that gave me chills when they're, you know, the scene where, you know, his wife is in danger and there's people in the room and all he can hear what's going on, there's nothing he can do. And it's that was a great use that I thought was particularly brilliant as far as the film goes.
Well, I think we've all been there, right? You know, it's a great point. I think that using that cell phone in ways, narrative ways that are somehow familiar to us in our everyday life. I mean, being frustrated with someone on the other end of the phone, whether it's the daughter and you're trying to get her out of the house and she's kind of lollygagging, or whether it's arguing with your buddy about the information that you need that he's not willing to share, whatever it might be. We've all experienced that. And that's actually some of my favorite performance from Frank as well, is the moments in between, the hat changes. You know, he's on the phone arguing with, negotiating for his life with a gangster, and then he's immediately switching calls to talk to his wife, who he's estranged from. And then his buddy who set him up with the job is getting on the phone, and he's got to switch hats again to try to kind of sleuth out some information from this guy. Then his daughter, his 13-year-old daughter, is calling, and he's got to switch over and kind of decelerate his panic and deal with her in kind of a fatherly, domestic way. So those hat changes that Frank does, I think you I don't know that I've ever seen those before, and I think it's because, or not often, and I think it's because those only happen when you're switching phone calls, when you're switching from one reality, one conversation with someone to a completely different conversation with someone else, and it happens in a fraction of a second. Whereas in, you know, a more traditional narrative that doesn't use a cell phone, you have to have that character physically change locations, typically, or at least you have to have one character enter and another character exit. And and so those hat changes are a little less pronounced, maybe. So the cell phone turned out to be a really fun element to the story. I was worried about it going in, and then it turned out to be a real asset.
Frank Grillo was absolutely great. He seemed almost born for the role. Was he? I mean, you already kind of answered the question. I scratched it down here, but at what point was he part of your vision? I mean, when you look back, do you feel like he was ever not part of it? Did you see somebody else in that role while it was being developed?
I mean, when I write, I try not to picture anybody in the role. I'm trying to fabricate a real human being as much as I can, a real behavior, truthful behavior. So I'm trying not to fill what is in my head is supposed to be a real person with the face of an actor. It somehow brings some artifice that can be very difficult to overcome, for me anyways. Do you do that as well? Do you picture anybody when you're writing?
I don't. And I tell you what, it really frustrates me when I read in fiction anyway, where they reference a character. Like, you walked into the room and he looked just like Rock Hudson. I think it's sort of
a cheat, and
I can't. And when people ask me about, movie stuff, like who would play this character, I realize then that I've had no one in mind. An amalgamation of some horrible people in my own life, but I never think of actors in the role. So it's always hard for me to answer, like, who would be good for a character.
Well, and it's honestly, as far as filmmaking, it's one of the most, arguably as a director, it's the, other than the script that you choose, other than the material that you choose, the actors that you cast, that you decide to collaborate with, is the single most powerful decision that you make. The most direct conduit between the story that you write and the audience is the performance, is the actor.
When War Party took it on, though, it was clear that it was going to be Grillo's role, right?
Yeah. So essentially, how this thing came to be is I wrote this script. I started to get some heat on it around town, interest from producers to purchase the script, and managers who wanted to sign me and help me sell it, and not a soul who even wanted to have a discussion about me directing it. And I got into screenwriting in order to create an opportunity to direct. So I went through about 4 months, maybe 4 or 5 months, of turning down a lot of potentially lucrative career-starting offers. And after 4 or 5 months of that, I knew Joe Carnahan very peripherally, and I shot him a text message. We had been looking for maybe a year. We had been looking to maybe try to grab a beer together. And I shot him a text message and just said, "Hey, Joe, I've got this situation. I know you probably went through this with your first film. Narc was his first kind of bigger film. And I'd love to ask you for some advice." So an hour later, he called me back and he says, Jeremy Rush, tell me what's going on, man." So I explained the situation to him. And
brother.
Come on, brother. Tell me what's going on. He loves that impression, by the way. Every time we get together with people, he is asking to do it. It's got a little too much like Hulk Hogan to it or something, but it's close. So he says, "So tell me what's going on, brother." So I tell him what's going on with this script and describe the situation. And he said to me, "Fuck all those people." He said, "Fuck them all. The reason they want it is because it's probably good. And you have to direct it." He said, "You can't sell it. You have to direct it. And I'm going to produce it. So you send me the script. I want to read it, make sure it's up to par, and we'll take it from there." So I signed the script thinking I wouldn't hear from him for a month. And 7 a.m. the next morning, I had an email in my inbox that said, "I love it. It's great. I think you could." He had a few notes, mostly about delineating the two bad guys. on the phone, just kind of making a little clear, more clear who was who. And after a couple of days of kind of sussing that out, we started talking about casting. And very early in the process, he asked me, what do you think about Frank Grillo? I said, dude, you know exactly what I think about Frank Grillo. I think the world of him. He's one of my favorite character actors. I've been following his career since maybe, I forget when, like the I think it was 2009, maybe 2008, 2009, when End of Watch and The Gray and some of his more prominent performances came out. So Frank loved the script, and we all got together. Joe and Frank and I, we got together at a little bar in Santa Monica area, and Frank and I hit it off pretty quickly. He's actually a pretty serious fighter. He trains like a pro MMA fighter. I'm much more recreational, but I've been fighting for a long time as well. So we kind of struck that chord together, and he liked my vision for the film, and of course I'm familiar with his work, and I was very fortunate that he trusted me to do this. I mean, it was basically him and me. It was me behind the monitor and him in front of the camera for 95% of the film. And he knocked it out of the park. He brought, I don't know that there's a lot of actors like Frank around anymore. So at least not in the United States, those kind of man's man, up by the bootstraps, credible kind of actors, Charles Bronson or something,
He's really underrated. There's a grit with him, like sort of a something bubbling under the surface that it just seems very legitimate with him. And I know his work mostly through watching Kingdom, which I love.
Sure.
But some of that, particularly towards the end of that series, it just amazed me. His range is because you it's kind of easy to sort of think that you could pigeonhole someone like him, because he's a tough guy, he's a fighter, and he is kind of a macho guy. But his emotional range is incredible, and it shows in Wheelman with James, not only with the daughter, but on the phone with the daughter in the start. Like you said, when he's being kind of playful at the beginning, and he's got to change hats, like you said, so quickly. Yeah, he's an amazing actor, and he carries the film really well.
I agree 100%. I was blown away every day that we were shooting, because we were shooting out of order, completely out of sequence. And in addition to that, Frank was not reading with the actual actors who were playing those various characters. Most of the time, 95% of the time, he was reading with just someone who was reading lines to him. So we had some actors on set that would just voice actors that would read the lines to him, but they would just read the lines fairly rote without a lot of emotion, because they didn't want to, we didn't want those to inform Frank's performance, and that's how he found it easiest. I mean, sometimes it was Joe reading with him, sometimes it was me, depending on the situations. So Frank showed up with a script that looked like the notebook from the serial killer from Seven. It was like completely notes drawn all over it, and chicken scratch and color coding. And he really deeply understood and mapped out the emotional arc of this character from scene to scene, so that he had, because he had very little time to calibrate before the cameras would roll. And he, he's got three kids. He's had a tough past, grown up in New York. And so he was willing to bring a lot of that to the character. So I agree 100%. It was real grit that he brought to it, not manufactured grit. Very rare, I think, in especially in American actors these days.
Well, let me ask you, who is the guy, I always forget his name, who played Clay? There is a scene, that has got to be one of the most nail-biting, brutal death scenes I've witnessed in film. The guy who played, Clay is the character's name. What's his name?
Garrett Dillahunt.
Yes. Who I see a lot.
Again, one of the finest actors we have. He's really, I just watched The Assassination of Jesse James by the Coward Robert Ford just 2 days ago, yesterday or the day before, I don't remember. And Garrett is in that film and gives one of the most heart-wrenching performances in a single scene that you can find. He's an outstanding actor. But, you know, that's the caliber actor that you get to populate the Frank Grillo Wheelman version of the film with. But
yeah.
That scene, you know, Garrett took that bull by the horns. I gave him very little instruction outside of what was in the script. And, you know, we had no time for any rehearsals at all in this film. We shot the entire film in 18 days. And so it's with lesser actors or less experienced actors, that could be really scary. But when you've got Frank Grillo, you've got Garrett Dillahunt, you've got Shea Whigham, you've got Caitlin Carmichael, who is arguably one of the most experienced actors in the movie, even though she's 12 years old. You surround yourself with people with that kind of experience, and it takes a lot of pressure off, you know. You tell them kind of what you're going for, and you have a lot of discussions going into it. But when it's time to push the little red button and roll camera, you let them run with it. It's my movie, but it's their character. And Garrett, just what a devastating scene. I mean, every time I watch that now, it's not very many scenes in the movie that I kind of get caught up in. I'm usually looking at the mistakes and the things I wish I'd done, but that particular scene is just gut-wrenching, and it's so fun to watch that particular scene in a theater with an audience, because you can just, the air gets sucked out of the room, and you can sense people kind of covering their eyes, and It's brutal. It's a brutal scene.
It truly is. You know, you mentioned it a couple times that it was shot in 18 days. I understand it was shot in Boston, but it feels kind of anonymous. It's just sort of, you know, some East Coast city. Was that intentional to kind of make it anywhere USA? Or was it supposed to be Boston and I just haven't been to Boston?
No, you're absolutely right. It was supposed to be kind of an archetypal East Coast kind of a vibe. We also looked at We shot in Boston, and Boston was just absolutely the right choice. But we also looked at cities like Baltimore. We looked at Philly. We looked at Detroit. So we kind of wanted to have that type of vibe. I remember the filmmakers that Killing Them Softly, they called that town Shitsville, USA. But that's kind of what we were going for, is just, you know, I really wanted to build real people and real places and make it feel gritty and real and tangible. But I also wanted it to be kind of ambiguous. You know, very few characters have full names. The main character, we never hear his name. He's just, I think he's referred to once in the movie as Wheelman. And I think that ambiguity, I don't know, it makes it feel, I kind of like that. I don't know exactly what it is, but you know, for instance, I don't know how you feel about this. I can't stand it when I read a script or I read a novel or I watch a film and every character has a name or a nickname and they all call each other or reference each other by those names, because we just don't do that in real life.
Yeah, that's
we
a hard lesson to learn.
We just look at the person and talk to them. It is, man. It's you think you have to do that, and you just don't. So I don't know. That might have been an affectation of my dislike for that kind of, I don't know, use of monikers, you know?
You know, a lot of the tone and language of the movie, it really rings true to me, having had somewhat of a dark and dirty past. Where did your history come from? Have you ever been a criminal, or did you just sort of learn this by osmosis, or from, you know, rolling with ruffians? How did that come about?
No, I mean, you know, a little exposure to it very, very peripherally, but no, not really. You know, I think it's just, I know you're the same way, Pat, our editor, is the same way. A lot of the writers I know are just very sensitive listeners, and you hear things, and you pick up on things. And so, you know, I have read a ton of screenplays and learned what doesn't work and what does work. Dialogue doesn't come super easy to me. I have to do a lot of research. I have to write the scenes over and over. I really have to inhabit those characters. I have to write scenes until I feel like I'm inside those characters' heads. And so I always say I have to write a couple thousand pages to get to the 120 that actually matter, you know, the 120 for the actual script. And a lot of that writing is just trying to get inside those characters. And so once I do that, then I can start to render what feels like organic dialogue onto the page. But, you know, a lot of that language comes from research and just, I don't know, I guess cataloging it from watching movies and reading things and seeing documentaries.
And I think you have to embarrass yourself in a room and speak it out loud. I think that's something that writers,
totally,
whether they're screenwriters or fiction writers, don't do enough. It's just, you got to say the lines out, even though, you know, someone might hear you while you're acting by yourself.
You know, I totally do that. I sit there chatting to myself, especially in the rewriting phase, going through it and just making sure it sounds right and what it needs to be or what it should be. I even do a table read when I get kind of a consumable draft of a script. I have a bunch of actor friends over and assign parts and just do a cold read around the table. Not for any other purpose other than really just what you said. It's like I need to hear the words out loud, but I can't hear them in my own voice anymore. And I find that to be really helpful. And then just back to what you said earlier about casting a guy like Frank is, you know, we would sit down in his trailer and go through a scene and be like, I don't know, Frank, does this ring true to you? And he'd say, nah, what if we said this or what if we said that? We also had an actor named John Sinatempo who has a colorful past that he was willing to kind of lend us some of his experience. And so we'd ask him, you know, how would the guys you ran with say this thing? And he would throw some ideas out there and we'd snatch one of those and put it in the script. So it's a fairly fluid process, just trying to find the phrasing or the whatever street idiom might work. It was really fun. We came up with some good stuff that almost all of it ended up in the film.
We're almost pushing up on our time, so I got to take this tiny moment to take some business here. This is a copyrighted broadcast, wholly owned by the Authors on the Air Global, the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network, and sponsored technically by the wonderful Down and Out Books, publisher of plain pulpy literature. So what's next for you? Is the phone ringing off the hook? What's going on now?
My phone is certainly not ringing off the hook, but it is ringing, which is a lot different than it was 2 years ago. So I'm, essentially what happens when you make a first film like this is that you are introduced to the town. People see your film, producers and production companies and studios. And people who think you might be right to either script something for them or direct something for them, they bring you in for what's called a general meeting, and you kind of just get to know each other. It's almost like speed dating or something. And so you get to meet a bunch of the movers and shakers around town and try to find people that you might want to collaborate in the future. And then, of course, you start reading a lot of screenplays. Some of them just for the sake of getting a picture of what open assignments and what projects are available, and then some of them are directly sent to you for consideration, and so you just keep reading stuff until you find something that sparks, and so that's what I'm doing now, is reading a ton of stuff. I read anywhere from 2 to, oh my gosh, I think 1 week I read 8 screenplays 1 week, and having discussions with the various entities that send those over, and then of course I'm writing every day.
Because that's where the passion is. It's got to be hard waiting in the sea of other folks' stuff, right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, pretty much everybody in this industry is subject to someone else. In order to go and do their craft, you know, directors are subject to writers writing material and producers greenlighting projects, and actors are subject to producers or studios or directors hiring them. Crew members obviously subject to getting hired on projects, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, you can kind of take a little bit of your fate back as a writer director in that, I am not solely subject to finding a piece of material before I get to go flex my directing muscles. I can sit down and face the blank page and try to render my own story onto the page to then try to get it off the ground and go direct it. So then the only hurdle I'm largely facing is trying to attach cast or trying to essentially raise the resources to make the film. So it's, yeah, and I don't know. I mean, I know you feel this way too. We talked about it a little bit when you came and visited the editing room, but writing, at some point writing, if you're a writer, that's the lens that you see the world through. So even if I didn't ever have to write again, I had a stack of 50 screenplays on my desk that I was going to try to go make in my lifetime, I would still probably be writing. That's just the way I see the world. And I, as far as directing something, I'm pretty particular with my taste, and I have kind of an experimental edge, which I think Wheelman shows a little bit of. And I know no one else is going to write a story that fits my taste better than I will. Best shot is to find another piece of material that I feel like I could bring my taste to it in some kind of a singular way to help enhance and elevate that piece of material. So that's kind of the game I'm playing now, is reading screenplays to see if it's something I feel like I could really bring something to it. And then the other half of my day, or the other three quarters of my day, is spent trying to put words on the page, which, as you know, is a brutally painful process.
Yeah, well, sometimes it's more pleasurable to be there than in the real world. So as well as an exercise. Well,
you can tell what kind of process I'm in. Then it's not flowing yet.
So, yeah. Well, you always hear that. You know, it's 10% inspiration and no. The part about the edit. What is it? Write drunk, edit sober. And I found the reverse is a bit better for me. Writing drunk doesn't really help, but I think it's better when I look back and edit it. I don't beat myself up when I edit it, but sometimes I do when I write it. So it's in reverse for me. But listen,
it's hard to take off
that
judge's hat, man. It's very difficult to take off that editor's cap that isn't sitting there saying, "Oh man, what you're writing right now is not good."
Well,
come back to it later.
I'm not a person that believes in crashing through a first draft and it'll all be fixed later. I kind of gotta get it right as I go along, bit by bit. So by the time I do come back, what I think is a first draft, but really it's about my 53rd draft. I feel like it's pretty good. So I can bet myself on the back a little bit at that point.
It sounds familiar, man. It sounds very familiar.
Listen, we're pushing up against the time. So I want to thank you. This has been a good lesson in basically staying true to your vision. And that's the feeling I got from the verisimilitude, the authenticity. I don't know what to say, but the feel and tone of that movie are not like a lot of other stuff out there. And I highly recommend anybody out there in the world, if you have not seen Wheelman, wherever you are in the world, it's easily accessible there on Netflix, and you're in for a ride, quite literally. Thank you again, Jeremy, and I hope to speak to you soon. And I hope all the best wishes for you in your next endeavor. I'm sure we'll be hearing about it.
Thank you very much, man. Yeah, I hope so. I'm looking forward to whatever it may be as well. I appreciate it, Tom. I appreciate the support, and I appreciate the interest. And thank you for having me on your show.
Trust me, it's my pleasure. I'll send you a gushing email later, and I'll be off to bowling shortly. Thanks again, and here comes the outro music.
Cheers, man.
All right, thank you.